Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. My guest today is Kate Lindsay, who is known for writing about internet culture in her newsletter Embedded and all sorts of publications like The New York Times, The Atlantic, and GQ. Some recent topics she's written about are online username markets, moms face-tuning their children unwillingly, and remote work productivity monitoring. Besides writing about the internet, she also sometimes makes ceramics about it. She's currently selling handmade mugs painted in the patterns of New York Times games Wordle and Connection Grids. That's an abbreviated intro of who you are. Do you have anything to add?
No, other than I hope by Christmas I'm going to also do just traditional crossword mugs as well.
Oh, okay. That's a lot more work, though.
I know. That's down the line.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess we'll start with Embedded, into plenty of other things. It's a regular newsletter. I think it's usually 3 days a week, sometimes 4, sometimes 2. You've got Sundays are like link roundups, mm-hmm. Classic newsletter form. Mondays and Wednesdays might be some of your essays. And then Fridays are often this like written interview series called My Internet. Am I missing anything? What would you describe it as?
I would say the aim is always 3 times a week, an essay on Monday, an interview on Wednesday, and a My Internet survey on Friday. And the My Internet survey is a little bit, because an interview is normally about something specific that a person or creator is doing, whereas My Internet is, we just find cool people and
templatized.
Ask them, how they fill out a survey about how they spend their time online, which is always fun.
Okay, cool. So No Filter was the editorial arm of Influencer.co, which I understand is like a two-way influencer marketplace, slash kind of social media network. In May 2020, they hired Nick Cattucci to make an editorial outlet for them, which was No Filter. He hires you 2 months mm-hmm. later to be kind of the sole writer. You write presumably hundreds of articles for the website. And then 1 year later, out of nowhere, it shuts down. Embedded becomes a, out of the ashes, rises as a Substack, whatever. And then Nick remains editor and you remain writer. So that's like, I don't know. Do you want to add any color to that?
No, I'm so shocked at how thorough the research is down to the month. I mean, I had been at Refinery29 for like combining full-time and freelance 4 years before that. And while I was there, I always grew up watching YouTubers specifically. And so my scope was really small in the beginning, which was just like, I think I was on the entertainment team and I remember just being like, we should be writing about these YouTubers. But this was pre-pandemic. And so it was just an uphill battle to get it published. But it was kind of crazy. Like the moment the pandemic hit and nothing was filming, like some things were still coming out, but it was like suddenly my skill set was valuable because everyone was making content online or turning to content creators. And so it kind of was a coincidence, but like that also coincided with me going to No Filter because I've been at Refinery for a long time. I basically felt like I didn't know what was next there. And I knew that if I, like, it was one of those things where I could easily just stay there until I got laid off, it would have happened.
That's what it does.
But I was like, you know what, if I don't, I'm never going to leave if I don't leave now for this, because it was like a bit of a risk. It was a, totally brand new. But I figured if I could just, one, get out, make some progress, and two, just see what it's like working somewhere where it's just internet culture coverage and we can shape it and grow it. I learned just a lot about starting something and wrangling interviews when you don't really have anything to point to. So it was definitely really good. And we grew quite a bit. But it was just one of those things, like the economic times were really bad. And, when you're looking to cut something, it is often editorial that goes first. And so, but luckily we were able to just take it and transition it into, we were able to use the old email list because we didn't send out highlights as a newsletter. We basically were able to use that list to, we couldn't take the emails, but we could email them and go, hey, we're moving to
opt
this.
In. Yeah. How big was it, the email list?
Email list was pretty big. It was like, I think 30,000. We got maybe 500 people who opted in, which isn't bad. It's not starting from scratch.
In terms of like a click rate, I mean, that's pretty good.
So we got 500 people-ish. And then, some people just from the announcement. But really, it's just sort of grown, I would say, by like but it grows steadily at about 10K per year free subscribers. And so we're at, I was looking at all this stuff because I'm actually very hands-off with the numbers for my own emotions. But I was looking just so I could come prepared. And so, yeah, we're close to hitting 35K right now, nice. Which is crazy and like still not, it's still something that for the most part, I just send off into a void and I'll get like some feedback, but really like it's been very weird, especially as it was something that started in the pandemic. And now we're all sort of out and about again to like mm-hmm. run in and see living, breathing people who are like, oh, I read your newsletter. And it's so, that's still weird to square, but I love it. Yeah.
When you made the transition and mm-hmm. started Embedded, I'm curious how like the editorial mission or voice changed, or if it did at all, like, and I'm sure now it has. So I guess mm-hmm. like, how was it different, if at all, maybe those first few months to year, and then from that, how has it changed to now?
Well, yeah. So when it started, it was more like the original website, which was creator interviews. And we also were doing it because we had a very generous severance that we were able to like, for 3 months, we were like, okay, let's just pretend this is our job now.
It was like seed funding.
Yeah, that the severance mm-hmm. is paying us. And it was unmonetized. I think I was writing 5 days a week, like just something really short every day. And so that was good in the sense, and this is what I'll always say when people ask, is like, now it's just like, I think it could be very easy if you are in charge of your own publishing. If you don't have an idea, it's really tempting to be like, well, I just won't write something. And what I think was good about, especially because Nick took it very seriously. And like mm-hmm. the theme of all this is going to be that Nick looks at the numbers. Nick is the one.
Well, because he has like, I don't know, like 20 years of experience. In
yes.
Or
yeah. Right? So if mm-hmm. I didn't, I think if I worry that if I hadn't had him to be accountable to, I don't really know if it would have
awesome.
Done as well. Yeah, no, it's really great. And so like, yeah, so I just, and I think it's helpful to get yourself in a routine of like, needing to come up with an idea and not saying that they're bad ideas, but it just makes you, if you're just waiting for inspiration to strike, you know, maybe that's what like the idyllic writer life is like, but it's not one for a writer that needs to sort of
not for the 21st century.
yeah. And so it's good. And also you push yourself. And I'm also someone who very much will just start with a vague idea and then find what it is I really think, or I'm trying to say as I'm writing. And then I go back and like reangle it.
That's like the point of writing, right?
Yeah. And so the first year was very much that. But I think what we kind of also were, we wanted to lean into what was exciting about having a newsletter, which was we weren't writing a website where we were trying to convince strangers to click. We were ostensibly sending out writing to people who had already expressed a desire to read it. And so it meant that we were free from, writing an explainer on drama. And I really... that kind of allowed me to move a bit away. I mean, so much of my early internet career was explainers, and I do think those have a place, but I think one of the things I started to realize, and I've said this before, but is just when I was doing dedicated internet culture coverage at No Filter, I would talk to the people in my life about what I wrote about that day, and they would be like, I've never heard of that person or that thing. And I would kind of start to be like, and I think it's easy to be like, well, there's like regular people and the extremely online, but the regular people still have phones and they have Instagram and they have all this stuff. And so I was like,
you're getting like too inside baseball on like
right.
the moment
it
of
was
the day.
Just like, well, how is this internet culture coverage if it at a certain point it feels like I'm just writing for other internet culture journalists and not like act, because everyone uses social media and the internet. I mean, not everyone, but I just was like, okay, I just right now the internet culture writing is not indicative of the larger experience mm-hmm. of being on the internet. And I felt I was doing the importance of the internet a bit of a disservice by only writing about it through the lens of like, this teen is mad at this teen. Yeah. And like, us,
well, so
like,
you go from that, from like, this teen is mad at this teen to like, what's the, like, how do teens experience being online?
Yeah.
And like, what are the implications of that?
Yeah.
You move from like, you know, like micro to macro kind of.
Yeah. Through. What I've said is that rather than like, my beginning career was writing about what was happening like on the phone. And now I try to write about what's happening to the person who's holding the phone.
That's good.
And I find that can just, it, I just found when I think about it through that way, like frankly, the piece just does better. And so then, you know, it's like a not totally altruistic. I'm like, oh, like this, you know, I want to like the best feeling is just writing something people feel seen in. And unless they're a certain subset of internet user, they're, you know, they're not seen in the really specific micro trends that are happening. They're they're seen in the broader stuff, like why do dating apps suck now, things like
yeah,
that.
That's more relevant. Yeah, I did want to ask about like mm-hmm. how you make money. So I know mm-hmm. you have this. You're a freelance writer. You're like constantly mm-hmm. publishing articles. Mm-hmm. And then also like I only saw this in your Instagram bio. You work for this company, DM.
Yeah.
I didn't see it on your LinkedIn, but it was in your Instagram bio. So I was like, is this a full time job?
My LinkedIn. Oh, well, no, yeah, I just never.
We can get into LinkedIn later. But yeah, so what do you do for work?
Yeah, so I'd say like my main sources of income, and I'm like very open to being transparent about this stuff because I like don't think there's any reason to it mm-hmm. just like only helps people. So I would say my main income is embedded. I would say I have it so it pays me on the 15th of each month. It really actually fluctuates more than you would think, depending on who, you know, because there's churn, but then there's like sometimes you get an influx. And so I can get anywhere from, I would say like the base lowest that I get now would be $1,500 a month. But yeah. then the most I've ever gotten, I remember this was insane, was $3,000. And I don't super know what happened. It's just like who. And so I'll usually get something between that a month, which is my rent, yeah. essentially. And so then on the outside of that, yeah, I do have a contract with GQ where I write like a handful of stories a month. There's embedded, there's GQ, and then there's DM, which are all contract roles where I like log my hours. And so it's kind of like mm-hmm. those are just what I will get no matter what, because I'm doing those things. And yeah. then on top of that, so DM, I'm a newsletter editor yeah. there. And so what I am in charge, it's a part-time role. And I basically just, they have two newsletters a week. I either write them or I help curate them or help edit people who write for them and just get it out and just kind of keep it flowing. And also like I'm in meetings and come up with like ideas for the app. The app is, should have started with that. I should have explained.
It's like a search engine for.
Yeah, it's like they call it like Reddit for hot girls.
Yeah,
it's like a sort of crowdsource social search.
It's Fishwife Google.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You can come and like Google your or you know DM your problems, like either like if you want to know like about is this symptom normal for PMS or something, mm-hmm. or just. Like this really embarrassing thing happened to me. Can you talk me off a ledge or whatever, mm-hmm. which is good. So yeah, so I do their newsletter. And then yeah, on top of that, I freelance yeah. and The Atlantic, obviously yeah. I still like.
With The Atlantic, your title there was newsletter engagement editor. What does that yeah, mean?
That's a great question. I can tell you like the inside baseball of it all was that I had two competing job offers mm. and the original role at The Atlantic was a more entry-level role. But then I got this offer from BuzzFeed, which was more. And so they wanted to match it. But in order to match it, it had to be, because of union stuff, it needed to be a different title. And so that's why that's kind of the
So were you writing a newsletter there then?
Sometimes I would write it. Okay. It was really, the whole team was pretty nebulous because it was like this new initiative they started. And so we kind of all just did each other. Like mm-hmm. it was just like, we all did, like I was socialing stuff. I was literally just doing the production. I was writing or like going through and like editing stuff. Doing like strategy mm-hmm. stuff, ideas. So like really, really anything. And then also, because I was in there, I was like, well, I really want to try and write. And it took a lot of failed pitches. Mm-hmm. And actually, so the first thing I wrote for them was Millennial Pause, mm-hmm. which is so weird.
Big one.
I was scrolling the other day and Ariana Grande was on Penn Badgley's podcast and he started recording and then he was like, oh, I feel like I just Millennial Paused. And then she went, oh, you didn't Millennial Pause. And I'm like, it is so, it's just like in the lexicon mm-hmm. now. And that's so wild because I didn't coin the exact phrase.
You were writing as like a TikToker that you wrote.
Yeah,
about
a TikToker that. Did. And I noticed it like months before the Atlantic piece. And I wrote a little piece for Embedded that was just the Millennial Pause.
Which, oh, wait, also for anyone listening who doesn't know what it is, it's like when you start recording yes. and you're like, situate before you start yeah. talking, right?
You're checking to make sure it's recording mm-hmm. before you start. And the real sin is not doing that. I would say like people of all ages do that, but Gen Z knows to edit it out. And I think millennials mm-hmm. leave it in, and they do. There are some egregious pauses I've noticed. Yeah. Basically Taylor Swift had done it. And then this TikToker stitched it and was like, wow, even Taylor isn't immune to the millennial pause before you speak or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that's so funny. Like the millennial pause. And yes, I wrote it for Embedded. And then the executive editor, Adrian of The Atlantic, saw it and was like, you should do a piece on millennialisms for The Atlantic. And so the millennial pause was like the headline of it. And it was like the way in, but it was more broadly about the way that millennials are have these sort of hallmarks of an earlier internet. Yeah. And I that piece like changed my life. It's like kind of crazy because it just, I remember being like, I hope someone reads this because I hope my first Atlantic piece, you know, doesn't flop. And I've never had anything like it. I've had some things now close. Just in terms of like that, I know I'm going to remember certain things over others. I didn't anticipate how upset it was going to make some people. And so I dealt with a lot of that. I dealt with a lot of like pretty nasty comments. And to this day, I like cannot figure out why. I guess people felt it was like ageist. And I don't know, but it was.
I mean, me too. It's like 29 to like 44 now.
It's just, it was so weird. It's just like, no, like I think it's interesting. I think these anthropological things are super interesting about like how being on our phones. I also think it's something like, what a great thing to hold on to, that little bit of humanity of like, I am separate from my phone. I am checking. I didn't coin this. They being the nebulous audience on TikTok coined it afterwards. It's called the Gen Z shake, which is like, they are so embedded with their phones that like, they are recording when they're in the middle of talking. Just coming in and like they're putting it down. That you're getting like they couldn't wait. Exactly. And so I think that's just so interesting the way that even a little simple action, if you're pausing or if you're just starting, like marks how you grew up online. That piece. I'm kind of forgetting what question I'm answering.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Maybe we're here. Yeah. Okay, we'll move on to another one. I didn't want to stop you. It was good stuff. I'm curious though, like, given that you do both, you're a newsletter editor and a newsletter writer, what's like the relationship between those things? I don't know, like, what can you say about either role being on both sides of either role?
Yeah, editing has all. I'm not like an experienced editor. I did some editing at No Filter. That was technically my role was news editor, and so I would. But I have definitely found I do have more comfort as a writer, and so. The thing I try to do, especially with DM, a lot of the time we're getting, it's volunteer based, and right now they're still in the early stages of getting funding for that type of.
It's like volunteers of like people who like are power users of the app or something.
Yeah, yeah, people who are on the app or like friends of mine or friends of Emma, the founders. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very cognizant with that. So I would say that changes the editing a little bit because I'm cognizant that this person is not getting paid, and so
you can't be too harsh.
Yeah, so I basically just try to go through and clean it up for them and just be like, okay, here's either grammar stuff and then like here's where we can focus it a little bit or maybe like I understand what you're saying here. Maybe can you simplify it or like this is really good. Is there any way you could talk about this a little earlier? But like very light touch where it's just like I'm not going to send it back and be like take another stab at this. And they don't need that. Like the people who volunteer to do it are doing it because they're very passionate. So I try to be, because I think the edits I don't like, and Nick doesn't do this, but I've had editors in the past where it feels like it's just being edited to how they would have written it.
Yeah.
And yeah.
High school at my school newspaper.
Yeah. I was just the like, opinions here's what editor. I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, so I just like really, I really try not to do that. And I try to just be really like, both for being the payment reason and for just how I like kind of operate it. Like I think positivity is a better motivator than being like this is. So I try to be like, here's what's really great about this piece. Can we like push it more towards that? But I also feel very unqualified to give editing advice because I'm so much more of a writer. And so I just try to take from like what I've learned from being edited by Nick, like, okay, what normally gets taken out, cross it out.
Yeah. Okay. A different question. This is kind of annoying, but I guess what is a newsletter? What defines a newsletter? Like,
great.
I want to hear yours, and then I have one.
I think what it's because, like, especially on Substack and most of these other platforms, it exists as a web page as well, and so it is. Sometimes I'm wondering what I'm prioritizing. Like, the thing is, when it goes into an inbox, I can't see it, But I would just say what's different to me is kind of what I said earlier and how I approach it is that like I am exclusively writing for people who have expressed an interest in hearing from me. And so that just gives a kind of, it gives a kind of freedom, but it also makes me want to treat them, not that I would be disrespectful, but, you know, I like, I'm like very cognizant of like, this is a kind thing that people are doing.
You can have that more informal relationship, have those colloquialisms.
And so, and I'm also like, so like, I don't ever want to phone it in or anything like that.
Because, especially when they've paid the paying you to write
like,
this for
them. Like, I just feel
them.
So much like, more of a real relationship there where I just am like, no, like they, like I think that I say that only because a lot of my early career, like we mentioned, was during a time when like SEO, but also like Facebook was really big for news. And it was honestly,
were we ever so young?
I know. And it's not like you were writing with blatant disregard for the reader, but you were writing something that would have a headline that you knew what you were doing with it. And, or you knew it was going to make people mad and that's why you did it. And like, that's not super, sometimes I will be aware of, oh, this will probably make, well, for embedded, I really don't do that. Basically, embedded is like free from me trying to stoke a specific negative emotion from you to get you to read it. And I don't think I will ever do that. And I, some of my freelance pieces, I'm like, I will be writing something and be like, they're going to hate this. But it's different. Whereas like embedded, I'm not trying to make people angry. Like, I just want people to feel relatable or to like read the thing that they hadn't, that they've been thinking, but hadn't been written yet.
Yeah. That's a really good definition. I think it's, I was like trying to come up with a really umbrella one. I think I wrote this last night. I wrote it as an email written one to many sent on a regular basis. And
that's the most
like clinical, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. But I like you, I think the relationship there is is like more accurate. I don't know, it's a, I guess mine is trying to capture like, I don't know, I talk to people who are, it's more like business driven than creative driven, which is like, this is like, I'm constantly, you know, tweaking my theory of creator, which is like, currently it's like a Venn diagram, right? Where like, if you're trying to create content online and like, you know, with some goal of like audience building and monetizing or whatever, it's like you either are like creative driven and that's your skill, or you're like business marketing driven and that's your skill. And like at a certain point, if you want it to like be anything, do anything, you have to like meet in the middle somewhere, either by, you know, learning those skills or like working with somebody from the other side. And I've seen people who like are like clearly more the business marketing type of person, but like are trying to be a creator, and it's like, it's just not good. And maybe they've built an audience and it's not good. And it's like, oh, they should just like find somebody who's like a good writer and like they should work together or something. Which, okay, kind of moves into another question, another definition. What? How do you define the word creator? What is that term? Because you've also written about this a lot.
Yeah, I'm actually trying to, I think this is really nebulous, and this is something that I do think, so I'm working on a piece right now about basically AI rights after death for regular people. Of like, there are these services that can turn, you can turn your loved one into like a chatbot and keep talking with them after. And it's like, well, what if you don't want that? Like, kind of like a digital do not resuscitate.
This is like the next stage of like the Tupac, like hologram conversation.
And so, and it, but interesting, it's like, it's for the loved ones who've left, been left behind. Like, I don't know. I also think a lot about the ways that technology is used to avoid uncomfortable feelings, like that's what dating apps have done to dating, where it's like
de-risk and then, social life,
and now it's like, okay, if you are normalizing this, then we're like, what is that doing to grieving? Like, I just don't think it's going to be healthy. But basically, to be like, I don't want this to happen, and you're a regular person, it's, there are no laws to enforce that unless you are a personality or performer. And the definition of that is like someone who either, you know, makes their living from like singing, dancing, entertaining,
this is like a legal definition.
And so I forget the exact thing, but basically it's a definition that I think is outdated, because like, what does like you and I think it's safe to say are like not traditional celebrities, but like we are I would say personalities,
and we're creating this
communities.
Thing these things for distribution online.
Qualify to be like, hey, for that reason, can you not? And like, I don't And like what counts as like enough followers or whatever. So basically the idea of what makes a creator, I don't know, because I'm also feel like right now the kind of big creators are not really that zeitgeisty anymore. Yeah. And people are way more interested in their, like they like feeling like a creator is theirs. They like a kind of smaller creator who maybe they see themselves in their job or their body type or just their lifestyle. Yeah. And it's a much more personal, smaller relationship. And like, that's still a creator.
Let me share my definition quick. I think this is constantly changing, but right now I think it's like at the most core, highest level, this is two umbrella. It's like somebody who is a creator rather than a lurker, somebody who's contributing to the conversation online in some way, a participant in the internet. But I think more accurately, still maybe a little too umbrella, but more accurately, it's like somebody who is creating actively, but like with the intent of building, of reaching people beyond their family and friends, right? Yes, so you're not just like private Instagram photos for, you know, here's what I'm up to, I'm at the beach. Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm trying to reach an audience, or I'm trying to monetize. But then that monetization, I think, is so broad, from like ad revenue, brand deals to like, I'm just trying to raise my profile so I can get a better job. And that's also monetization. So I think, I mean, to your conversation, but like, where does it, where does the border lie? I feel like it's like anybody who is making connection, anybody who other people have a parasocial relationship with, no matter how few, even if you just have one of those, right? Which goes back to what I was saying with the newsletter, where it's like you're sending it one to many. And so like, if you're a creator, it means you're creating content one to many that's meant to reach people beyond people you know in real life, right?
Yeah, I know, I agree. I think if you're opening up Instagram and posting with an awareness of an audience, then that is posting as a creator. And I think about it because I remember like growing up, I was always like, I want to be a writer. When can I call myself a writer? And the thinking was always like, if you write, you're a writer. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, if you make a reel, are you a creator? Maybe. Mm-hmm. Like I said that, but that like, it's hard because also that's just like, so not the same level of respected.
Well, it's, I think then it's like, this goes back to like the money difference. It's like, maybe you're a creator, but maybe what a creator is in this way that like we're kind of talking about it is like a media business, and a creator is just a type of media business that's like personal brand driven, like Mr. Beast, obviously, like huge version of that. But like, so is, I don't know, like Nolita Dirtbag in a way.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's pretty vague and I think it's changing, but I think it's kind of like, if you're doing the work because it is work, then yeah, like you can call yourself that, even though like I think I would, you know, you can feel bashful about it the way I probably used to feel bashful about being like, yeah, I'm a writer. But like, I do have the backing now of like being able to say I get paid for it. But I don't think like you said, I don't think you have to monetize in that way. I think if you have an audience who you are creating content for, then you are creating.
The benefits are bigger. Real quick, I do want to touch on embedded stats. We talked about it briefly. You said you're around 35K. I guess the other stats would be open rate, click rate, and then like percentage of subscribers who are paying for you.
Yeah. Okay. So the open rate, the bigger the free subscribers are, you know, the open rate gets a little, like once we tipped over 30,000, the percentage went down. So it used to be in the like 42% open rate. Now I'd say it's like 36% open rate. I was looking
for. Which is also like email wide is happening right now, I understand, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I would say the views range between 20K. Yeah, they're in the 20Ks, 25. And then we will occasionally have something that like takes off and just gets like a ton. Like
the productivity monitoring one, I believe, right?
Yeah, that one did well. Right now I'm just it falls anywhere between 20 to 30K views. And it is always falling around a 35 open rate, and I mean there are always some flops.
What about like click rate, maybe like on one of the Sunday link roundup issues, because your other essays aren't necessarily about clicking, the link roundups.
So my most recent Sunday scroll had a 61% open rate, I'm always like, how is this working out? Because it has like 316 opens, but then 683 total views. I don't know what that means, but basically the link click rate is 18%.
Oh, that's pretty good. Yeah.
It's pretty good. Yeah, it's not like the numbers aren't huge, but I also like it. It's a smaller pool of people, and I don't do a ton of links because I thought I would have a lot more, and it turns out I like actually am not.
Well, you're less online these days, right?
I know. I literally was like, God damn it! Like, I need to be like. So, but you know, I just will go through my history. I'll go through my group chat. I'll try to like make. I want to make it super organic. Like, what are me and my friends talking about? What's getting shared?
Today in tabs.
What did I actually read? Yeah, and so yeah, it'll vary. And then I'll always do like some self promotion. Notably, I did just notice in that link roundup, absolutely none of the links were anything I wrote. But it was like good because they're linking on the stuff I recommend, like the stories from GQ, and I didn't write that, but it was like one that I was jealous I hadn't written. And
one more question about stats quick. How is the audience growing? You said it's been like 10,000 free subscribers a year, basically. Is that like, do people come like through, you know, when you write for GQ or whatever, they look up your name? Is it like the My Internet? Cause I know the My Internet is always free. Is it like people?
It's honestly, there will be, and I would say earlier on, there were more spikes. Like someone I have to shout out is Rachel Carton, who does LinkedIn bio,
the goat.
Did really early on just put randomly in one of her newsletters, like, I really like this newsletter embedded. And that's probably like sort of percentage wise compared to what we already had, like our biggest spike. And then from then on, it would be just like someone genuinely recommending it. Now, I do think it just just every piece either it gets shared or like, yeah, it's a creator who I'm interviewing shares it, or the My Internet person. It just, I would say mostly it comes from collecting people along the way. But when I do write something, when I write something in the Atlantic, it's in my bio and I'll notice that it'll get a few people. But it's funny because people are not, I remember one time I was, the Washington Post wanted to quote me about something and like they linked to embedded. And I remember being like, oh, like it's in the piece, it's the link. And I would say like maybe two subscribers. And so it's just like, I think it really comes from, like, I think broad endorsements on like from like legacy, like it people kind of glaze over it. I think it's really if someone who they follow, who they like, or a friend forwards it to them, they'll do it. Because I just know it just is little by little, a handful every time something goes out. And that's how it grows. And for paid, for a while, I was doing something they would tell you not to do, which was I just paywalled the interviews because I was being like precious about my precious little essays and I wanted as many people to read them as possible. But that was what people liked, and you either are interested in an interview or you're not. And also, you know, the person who you're interviewing is less inclined to share it if it's paywalled. It was not a good strategy. So this year, starting at the end of last year, I switched it. I have one free essay a month, the rest are paywalled, and I had to just like get over it. And then unpaywalling the interviews is great because then they share it and people can read it and you get, it was like, I was like for 2 years making a bad business decision. And really our paid subscribers were not growing when that was the case, because at the time I was employed full time at places. And so it was just what mattered to me more was like the bigger number. But then now I'm just way more concerned, or, you know, not concerned, like I'm way more
living sustainable
interested in like paid subscribers and making it sustainable rather than, because once you do hit a certain number, it's not possible that over 30,000 people are all exactly really dedicated to embedded. You're getting a lot more like surface people, surface people, but like,
as opposed to mole people.
Mole people. Yeah. You're just getting people who are like, oh, sure, I'll subscribe because I see that this is a popular newsletter. It's what I'm saying is not meant to be a diss on any like recent followers. It's more that like, I notice this happens to big creators where like someone like Charli D'Amelio, who has 100K, no, my God, that's so low. She has 100 million.
Well, how your engagement rate goes down as you grow.
Her engagement rate is really poor because I think some people just start following because they've heard about her and are like, sure, I'll follow. I'm not saying we're Charli D'Amelio. But it is, I do think you reach a certain level where it's just
That's the headline for this newsletter, the Charli D'Amelio of Substack.
Of Substack. It's more that like, Basically, what I think I've learned is like it does read as a disservice to like just think about growing numbers. And now I'd rather the people who are kind enough to like pay, or the people who are kind enough to be really engaged readers who don't pay, who exist and are great. Like I want to write for them, and I'm glad to have other people there. That's almost, you just have to pick. You have to focus your efforts a little bit. It's hard.
Yeah. I'm reading Taylor Lorenz's book right now, Extremely Online, and she was talking about how like blogger, like back, you know, 25 years, a quarter century ago, blogging started. And then like people were like, oh, nobody was going to want to read that. It's like, it's not edited enough, et cetera. Mm-hmm. People start reading blogs. Actually, it turns out people do like, even if it is lower quality and more colloquial, yeah, or whatever, 10 years later, they start doing, you know, the bloggers start getting absorbed back into like traditional media, mm-hmm, or like new media institutions. Yeah. And then, you know, 7-8 years later, then it's newsletters. And I feel like we're having this conversation again. Mm-hmm. And then like newsletter writers, like, I mean, not that you were not a newsletter writer first, but, like you, Ryan, mm-hmm, Broderick, Jack Rains of Young Money are all newsletter writers writing for, mm-hmm, Sherwood. Right. And yeah. I'm like, is it just this? So there's two kind of things in here. Is it just like this endless cycle and like panic over like creators are the new journalist, like the journalist creator, yeah, is the model? Like I have a feeling that maybe it's just like this like wave of, you know, institutional people leave, people get laid off, etc. Mm-hmm. Maybe the more interesting question within this though is about media literacy, and I feel like, mm-hmm, people that meet, like there's less trust in institutions and like, yeah, big news outlets than ever, and people are going more to indie creators and creator journalists, mm-hmm, but I'm not sure whether or not that actually represents like an increase in media literacy and like skepticism and like, you know, mm-hmm, analyzing a bit what you're consuming by going to the individual, or is it just like moving that trust in the institution to the individuals? Yeah. I don't know. Media literacy, what's the state of it?
I think it's the same reason why I would say that influencers are falling out of favor. I do think there is this inherent skepticism of these institutions, which are people with enough power that you then, or that have, it's hard to trust them because, yeah, an influencer who gets tons of followers and suddenly gets like leveled up is not coming at you as a relatable person. They're like kind of in a new tier. You don't know if you could trust the recommendation because
what are the motivations?
They're kind of just a billboard now. Mm-hmm. Same, I think, with there are flaws and biases within institutions. I've like,
they're just people at the end of the day.
Yeah, or it's like, and you know, and there's a lot of stuff behind the scenes that you also can't talk about if there's like an issue with why this piece went out weird, mm-hmm, the way it did, or like why this and so basically there's just an honesty that can't happen because you're protecting, mm-hmm, like there's a, like you're protecting decision. This isn't anything in particular, but like, yeah, like it just, I just think you have to be, there's an awareness that you don't know what's, I think the black box of what's, yeah, happening, mm, behind the article, people can fill in with their own skepticism. And, yeah, so I think it's like, because, you know, there are some times where I'm like, you know, the New York Times like publishes one opinion and they publish the other and people are like, so what is it? And like, that's, yeah, a comprehension issue. Like it's not their job.
Well, like, and I'm constantly like checking like the headline, like what are the head, they change the headlines like four times a day. Yes, I'm checking, yes, the app, yeah, just to monitor, uh-huh, that now, not even to read the article, but just to monitor, yeah, how they're reframing.
Well, oh, like actually this is a good example. It's like in the cut published something, an article from someone where it was like, motherhood didn't change me at all. And, mm, then they published something that was like, motherhood changed me. And all the comments on that one were like, what, you just said it didn't change you. And that I think is an effect of like a parasocial, like, yeah, everyone's, it's like, well, that's because The Cut is not a singular person. It is an outlet that publishes many, many opinions. Like
that's the difference between, yeah, the institution and the creator.
But I think when you're raised to, cause that's also another thing I will even have when I write something, like millennial pause, I would be like, people are making fun of millennials online. And then all the replies are like, why are you making fun of millennials? And it's like, no. I am reporting on something that's happening from the outside. But there's this, I think, from growing up with creators and getting news that way, it's very like, they think, they're like, it's you doing this. You, yeah, are the face.
Mm, that's interesting. One more question.
Yeah.
Do you have any advice for people who write newsletters, given that you've been doing this for years, both for institutions, yeah, and yourself?
Yeah, I would say like, I mean, like it is like, because I started in media like 10 years ago, and I feel like I spent the first 5 years of my time in media feeling like I wanted better for myself, or feeling really stuck. I got like, I'm really grateful for how I got into media, and I had a lot of like fun, but then it was really hard to grow. And I think I was annoyed because I was like, had so much noise around me from other people that not because I was like, I wasn't annoyed that I wasn't like a staff writer of the New York Times because I thought my work was like warranted that, but I was like annoyed at myself for not having gotten there yet. And not allowing myself like the fact that you need time. And
crucial ingredient.
Yeah. And I would say like, you just now being able to look back on 10 years, it was like the slow grind of all those things. And I can point to like meeting that person or writing that thing or answering that DM that then led me to this. It's like the ripple effect that happens and of like everything is connected and everything I have now is built on that, just because like that is the inciting incident for some relationship or whatever. But then also specifically newsletter is what I mentioned earlier, like consistency. Like I said, like our followers don't come because of some like big thing. It comes because like for the most part, every three days a week or four, if you are a paid subscriber, you're getting the same thing. And every time you get like maybe it would start with like maybe three free subscribers. Mm-hmm. Maybe then you get 10, maybe you have one that blows up. But it's like you have like
one foot in front of the other.
Yeah. And you have to keep doing it. And I think the hardest part is the beginning when you're not going to get the numbers you want. And just trusting that you have that. Yeah. One foot in front of the other. Just like you have to keep coming back and doing it, because like it's pretty rare that you're going to start a newsletter and suddenly become like a superstar. It's like pretty rare that you're gonna start a newsletter, yeah, and even over time become a, yeah, superstar. Like that can't be why you're getting into it.
Charlie D'Amelio. Actually,
yeah it's just like, it's like I said, like I feel like we're in a pretty good place, but it's nowhere near my full-time income, so it's, yeah, just like but what it is valuable, it has been in sort of more you know, it has risen the profile or whatever of my work and,
yeah,
brought you and gotten me a lot of opportunities. And also I think makes my work better because I'm forced to write every week. It can never get rusty.
Yeah. No, that's, I mean, I think it's like the simple but best advice. Anyways, where should people find you?
Yeah, sorry. I was just taking a sip of seltzer. Yes. Yeah, so Embedded on Substack, three times a week or four if you feel like paying. And then I am Catherine Fiona, Catherine with a K and a Y, across all other social media, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok. Twitter's kind of a wasteland, but it's
more
Instagram
active on TikTok these days, you are.
I am. Every so often I'll brave it, but it is so scary. It's the meanest
twice a month
place.
Yeah.
But I would say Instagram is the place to go if you want like real updates. But I would say, yeah, actually, no, sorry. I would say Embedded is the place to go. See, that's why I'm not
there. We go.
This.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Well, this has been the Creator Spotlight Podcast. Kate Lindsay has been our guest. I have been Francis Zier, and I will be Francis Zier next week. And I'll see you then.